Les colloques du Collège de France.
Now we'll now move on to the lowly bacteria, truly amazing bugs. And so for that we'll have Tam Mignot from Marseille, who will give us a talk on Myxococcus collective motility. Tam has been studying Myxococcus since he was young age, I guess, for a long time. And he discovered the mechanisms of adhesion of Myxococcus on substrate and single cell motility, but I think he will tell us about collective motility. Anyway, thank you very much, Tam, to be
okay. So this is working well. Thank you, Thomas, for this nice invitation. I'm delighted to be here. And so yes, I'm going to talk about collective movements. And in fact, I'm starting with this slide, which I actually stole from Thomas a while ago when he was presenting collective movement, because it really, really struck me as a phenomenon that was very similar to the things that we were trying to disentangle, you know, studying this bacterium I'm going to introduce in the next slide, which is Myxococcus xanthus. And really, it's this fascinating behavior. This is captured from drones in the hills of Scotland. And you see those really mass movements, mass transitions that are governed by very simple cues, you know, a hole in a fence and a few shepherd dogs. And the entire population can really transition very quickly from one state to another and transition from one field to the other. And so really, I would argue today is that there are parallels between the behavior of these sheep and the behavior of the bacterium. And really, I'll try to make the argument that it's only a few cues that can really, you know, completely change, you know, multicellular behaviors. And so the organisms I'll discuss today it's this bacterium, Myxococcus xanthus. You see it moving on a plate of agar. And arguably, you know, intuitively, you see those movements of groups of cells and then single cells. And those groups, you know, are kind of reminiscent of the behavior that you've seen in the previous slide. Okay, so what am I talking about when I'm talking about Myxococcus xanthus? I'm talking about a predatory bacterium that we can grow as a colony on the plate, and it will expand by motility on the surface towards the prey here. Here, this prey is E. coli. And you see that it undergoes a first transition phase, which is, you know, invasion of the E. coli prey cell, lysis of the E. coli prey cell, and this is the actual feeding phase. And this feeding phase will then be followed by a very fascinating behavior, which is the propagation of those waves across the E. coli colony. And you see that those waves are propagating only where the E. coli prey was initially spotted, right? And in this area that's depleted of nutrients, you see a final behavior, which is the so-called aggregation stage, where the bacteria move in 3D and now start making those aggregates, and inside those aggregates the bacteria will form spores, and this is the dormant state. The beauty of that system is that you can capture any of this transition in a single petri dish over the course of 60 hours, so you can really study those transition and link scales from cellular scales to multicellular scales. And this is really the way we go about this. I just want to show you, this is basically the same image that you've seen. This is the Myxococcus colony here. This is the E. coli colony. It's dark because here you're looking at stain labeled bacteria. The E. coli colony has not been stained, and Myxococcus is labeled in red fluorescence. But what you don't see yet is that this is actually a giant image which has been basically stitched from, you know, 3,000 images resolved at single cell resolution. So you have a depth that captures the entire community, but then you can zoom in this image, and if you zoom in this image, then you can resolve single cell behavior within this collective. And you see, for example, if you're interested in a particular macromolecular complex, you can even also resolve the macromolecular complex within that community. And so this gives us a really powerful tool to link single cell behaviors to multicellular behavior, which is really what I'm going to be discussing today. You can, just a few examples to do a little bit of biology before I get into the question. You can, for example, decide, for example, to zoom at the invasion stage, and you see, for example, Myxococcus labeled with red fluorescence invading the E. coli, and you saw all the single cells moving and at the front of those groups of cells, and it looks like those single cells are actually digging holes and grooves that are followed by the cell collectives. We've been, for example, studying this, you know, for example, and zooming even more And now you can resolve, you know, the penetration at single cell resolution. So this is a single Myxococcus cell penetrating an E. coli colony. And you see that when the cell is actually contacting the E. coli, it's actually killing the E. coli by contact. And as it does so, it's actually creating a groove. And this groove will then be followed by the rest of the community. Just to do a little bit more biology to show you that we can link, you know, those behaviors to to molecular events. You know, this is, you know, in one snapshot, you know, what we've been doing in last recent years, trying to find the molecular complexes that are important for contact-dependent killing. And you see that this bacterium assembles a sort of a needle in its envelope. So this is really a syringe-like, you know, a molecular machine that's assembled in the bacterial inner membrane powered by ATP, which then extrudes a filament, and that filament is seemingly toxic, and that's how it actually kills the prey cell. And you can image the activity of that complex in vivo. For example, if you label a protein of that complex by fluorescence, and this is a protein that localizes at the base of the complex, this is a Myxococcus cell here, this is another Myxococcus cell here, and this is an E. coli cell. And before I start the movie, you see that the fluorescence is rather diffuse. But you see that very quickly, the fluorescence condenses at the contact site, and this is rapidly followed by the death of the E. coli. So there is really a sense of touch in these cells that they can detect prey, dynamically assemble those complexes, and kill the cells. But really what I want to discuss today here, back to the topic that we have today, is really try to explain or understand the molecular multicellular transition, which is quite striking, which is the transition from, you know, this behavior, which I'll be referring to as swarming on the left side, and this behavior, which I'll refer to as rippling, which is the formation of those waves. And you see that those two behaviors are really separated by a very clear line of demarcation, which is really the borders, the initial borders of the prey colony. And if I start the movie, this is really those behaviors. When you see, this is in fact, of course, greatly accelerated. It's 16 hours in real time. And you can really see that the cells go from this to this, you know, with a very sharp border. So the question is really, how is this occurring? And can we actually link what we know from single cells to explain this type of very sharp transition? And to explain this, I'll make two very simple hypotheses. Okay, the first hypothesis is that this is linked. This ability to do those behaviors is linked to ability of cells to reverse their direction of movement. And what I mean by a reversal is if I look at a single cell moving in one direction, I can see those events where the cell will actually direct its movement in the opposite direction in such a way that the pole that was initially at the front is actually converted into the lagging pole. And I'll come back at the later on to what are the molecular processes that derive that. And the second hypothesis is really that this transition is so sharp that it should not require any sort of genetic reprogramming. Okay, so we will completely cancel any effect linked to genetic reprogramming. Those genetic transitions could occur as a consolidation step downstream, but they should not be required for the actual transition. So when you start from a movie like this, how do you actually process, you know, variables or, that you could actually extract to characterize those two states? So this is how I will start, by telling you how can we look at these processes and determine, you know, what characterizes the rippling state and what characterizes the swarming state, and use those measurables to actually, you know, try to basically simulate those behaviors. So the first variable that we basically looked at is cellular alignment, and we used, you know, metrics from the people working in nematic crystals, in liquid crystals. So basically, you know, as a very simple explanation, if you're looking at your standard isotropic liquid, the molecules are not aligned, but in liquid crystals, which have the properties of a liquid, the molecules are aligned, and you can quantify this alignment, which is shown here, by the so-called nematic order, such that the molecules that have the same alignment are color-coded the same. So if you consider that your bacterial field is actually behaving like a liquid crystal, then you can apply this analysis to this movie I've shown you before, and now what you see beautiful, you know, colorful transitions occurring in a swarming area, telling you that the alignments are very rapidly broken and rearranged in these areas. But as you move into the rippling area, you see that the blue colors, or the cold colors, are persisting over very large distances, telling you that in this case, the alignment is persistent over very large distances, okay? And so, basically, the very simple first conclusion is that rippling fields are characterized by the cells becoming aligned over persistent distances, and I'll argue this is possibly due to a prey-dependent matrix. And in a swarming field, the local alignments undergo fast turnover, and I'll argue later on that this is possibly due to a self-deposited matrix. The second variable that you can extract from these movies is linked to these reversals, okay? So if I do an experiment where basically I'm looking at a rippling field on the left side, and this is again the separation, and this is a swarming field, and then this multicellular systems, I've introduced, you know, fluorescent cells, you know, green and red, to increase the throughput to actually score cellular trajectories and measure reversals. What do I see? So if I do this over the rippling field, okay, and this is actually boxed in blue, and what you see is the following. First, you know, if you actually draw a so-called chymograph along this line and look at the cellular density, now you see that basically you see the propagation of the waves is very obvious, you know, in this chymograph, as you see those basically crosses, which are basically reflecting densities colliding and apparently traversing each other. But if you actually follow the cell trajectories within those densities, now you find out that what's actually occurring is that the cells basically are moving along a wave, and when they reach the site of collision, they're actually turning back, moving along a wave and turning back in an accordion-like motion. So in fact, the cells are not actually traversing the field. They keep moving back and forth in an accordion-type fashion, okay? And so you see that cellular reversals are obviously governed, you know, by the fact that they are triggered at the collision wave transitions, okay? And so what you can extract, and this is actually, I must, you know, this is not the first observation. This is actually consistent with behavior described by others, and the authors are mentioned here. But what we measure here, which is new, is that you can actually extract the so-called time between two reversals, which is basically the time that separates two reversal events across the rippling field, and measure and basically spot their density. And you see that this distribution looks like it's bimodal, with two peaks, a peak here close to zero and a peak here close to six. This distribution is significantly different from the distribution that you see in the swarming area, where you see that the second peak is not present in the swarming area, and the distribution looks more like an exponential decay. Okay, so there is a distinct signature between those two areas, bimodal distribution in the rippling field, and this apparent exponential decay distribution in the swarming field. Okay, and so now, basically, based on this observable, let's try to model each of the behaviors. But before we can model these behaviors, you have to know how the cells are moving and how you can model the movement. And there is a fascinating feature of that system is that the cells can move, you know, in groups, as you've seen in that movie, and I'll refer to this movement as social motility, and they also can move as single individual cells, and this movement we've been referring to as adventurous motility. And remarkably enough, those motilities are actually governed by two distinct molecular systems. And so to get into those systems, I must really introduce the master regulator. And the master regulator is remarkably, it's a single protein. And it's a very well-known type of protein. It's a Ras-like small G protein. You know, and then we've solved the crystal structure of that protein. This is really a typical Ras-like fold. It binds GTP. And when it binds GTP at the front, it's active because this so-called switch run region is actually open and interacts with downstream effectors, which I'll introduce later. And the reason that this protein is at the front and ready to activate motility is that it's kept from the back by the second protein. And the second protein, called, I've been referring to as MGLB, it's an MGLA GTPase activating protein. It binds the MGLA protein as a dimer. And when it does that, it actually moves a critical arginine of the MGLA protein into the active site, which leads to the hydrolysis of GTP, and then the GTP bound state. Then you see this retraction of the switch run region, which is the inactive state. So in short, basically, this negative regulator at the back prevents this protein from binding at the back because it deactivates it spatially, okay? And so what those proteins do at the front is really linked to that protein is that first this protein can activate so-called type 4 pili, and those are retractile appendages that you see at the front of the cell. So you see the cell is moving by retraction of this pili, and this is the motor that drives the so-called social motility. This is molecular work that was done by Romain Mercier in the lab, very beautiful. I'll just cut short for it, is that this MGLA protein recruits and activates. And this activator, when it's anchored at the cell pore, recruits an ATPase, which then, you know, promotes the polymerization of the system. But suffice it to say that the MGLA protein basically promotes assembly of that system and its activity. But you have to know that there's this second motility system, and we've worked on it for years. And when the cells are single, again, this Ras-like small G protein, then it binds to another protein complex, and I'm not going to refer to it in detail, which activates a membrane complex. And this membrane complex then traffics in the membrane, and when it becomes tethered to the surface, then it powers the rotation forward of the cell. And it assembles so-called bacterial focal adhesions, we've been calling them. And you see those focal adhesions, and you can see them by fluorescence. And you see that, you know, when the complex is assembled, it remains fixed relative to the substrate, but the cell is actually moving. That's because it's actually propelling the cell, moving in the other direction. And this complex adheres to the substrate, and we've recently characterized the adhesin that you can label here with red fluorescence. But again, you know, I cannot get into the details of that system, and if you have questions, I'll be happy to answer. But really, for the sake of this presentation, I'm introducing the system to actually set up the rules of the model. Okay, and so the rules of the model for now are the cells become highly aligned in the rippling fields, because I'll start with modeling the rippling field, and I'll assume this is due to a predependent matrix, and two, the cells move either collectively by those type 4 pili, or they move as single cell by this amotility system. Now, I have to get into the question of what provokes Myxococcus reversals in the cell collective, and this has been a very long process to resolve. But let's look back again in this movie, and let's at this pneumatic field alignment. What you can get from this type of analysis is also that you can get basically the local alignment, which you can translate into those vector fields, and what you actually see in this animation are those blue and red dots, which are actually mapping where so-called topological defects are occurring. These are where basically fluxes are colliding, and you can get one type of topology when perpendicular collisions are occurring on this type of behaviors, and you can map out those topological defects across this entire basically time lapse, and then you can basically project those topological defects all at once to see what they're occurring. You see there's a huge hotspot of topological defect here. And so what's going on here is basically, if you zoom and look at fluorescent cells moving, you see that in those areas, the cells keep reversing back and forth, suggesting that where the cells are actually colliding, you get a massive enhancement of reversal frequencies. So, and this is basically quantification of that. So to really get you into what's going on, let me make an analogy with people crossing the road here, for example, at Tokyo Shibuya Crossroad, which happens to be the most busy crossroad in the world, where thousands of people are actually walking across that crossroad. And what's remarkable about this behavior is that those people are crossing, they're going where they want to go, with virtually no collisions, right? You know, there could be one collision every now and then, but really we're very error prone about that. And the reason that people can do this is that they can deal with what we've defined as a so-called frustration, okay? And so the frustration, for example, is highlighted by this lady. This lady, for example, wants to go from this area to this area. She's crossing an area here, and there's so many people showing up here that she has to take a turn and go, basically deviate from her initial trajectories, and very likely she will correct her trajectory back to where she wants to actually go, okay? Mathematically speaking, you can map those frustrations with a simple equation where basically you will map where basically they are characterized by either a reduction in velocity due to the fact that you're facing an obstacle, or a change in angle because you are actually changing, but you don't have to do both, okay? You can do either. And so if you take, for example, a Myxococcus, swarms, and now you are mapping the frustrations, okay, using this equation, and you can see what occurs in this frustration, and you can see, for example, that you can try to correlate to basically all the cells basically tempted to reverse at frustration areas. So basically here, the frustration is color-coded in the way that if it's redder, the more the frustration, and you see, for example, this example cells that it enters a high frustration state, it will tend to reverse. Of course, I'm showing you one single example. You can quantify this, and now if you quantify, for example, the distribution of frustration across trajectories, you can ask, where are the cells tempted to reverse across this distribution? And you see that the cells are reversing most likely in the high frustration zones, okay? So in other words, basically the cells reverse when they enter collisions, and then they have basically, traffic jams, okay? And so that you can then insert into the model with rule 3. The cells reverse when they are frustrated by crowding and collisions. to get in deeper into the model and again connect molecular regulations to cellular behaviors and even multicellular behaviors, I have to walk you into the molecular regulation of reversals. And I'll do it in the simplest way. I'm going to remove any sort of detailed complexity and tell you the essentials. Okay? So the essentials is that reversals are governed by the relocalization of those proteins I've already introduced, the MGLA and MGLB proteins, such that basically they are switched to the other end, and they are switched to by the regulation of this blue protein, which I did not mention yet, which is called the R protein. And if you want details about the R protein, I'll tell you more, but I'm not going to insist much on it. But you see that basically when the cells change direction, those proteins change direction. You can measure this, you know, for using single cell fluorescence microscopy. If you label those proteins with GFP, you can see the switch for the A protein. You can see the reverse switch from back to back from the B protein. And this is really how we got into the molecular genetics of that system. The importance here is that this transition is not spontaneous, it's not stochastic, it's actually driven by signal transduction in the form of a signal transduction pathway, a receptor that connects to a kinase which phosphorylates from ATP, this is where energy is consumed in that system, transfers this phosphate to so-called response regulator, the X and the Z protein, and in some way that's only partially understood, the action of this protein leads to that switch, okay? But what I'll do now is really give you critical properties of that signal transduction system that we used in 2D modeling. So just, a brief genetic evidence that this regulation is essential for the multicellular transition. This is a very simple experiment where we take a wild-type strain that's labeled with M-cherry, and we mix 1 to 10 with a kinase mutant, basically, if you make those mutants, they are very rarely able to reverse their direction of movement. And you see that initially the two mixes, you know, are able to actually penetrate the precolony. But after 72 hours, you see that the wild type, although it was diluted 1 to 10, basically entirely took over the prey, formed those beautiful rippling waves, and the mutant is completely excluded. So the ability to regulate this direction of movement in the way that I described is essential for those multicellular transitions. What do we know about that system? We know about that system that we have a dose response curve, that it's not a linear response transition, it's actually basically more of an on-off transition that switches very rapidly depending on cell density and actually depending on the transition, so that the cells are likely either in the off state, but when they turn in the on state, they basically very rapidly turn into the on state. Okay, so that's a very simple property. And this is, you know, the molecular details, that this is due to the activity of this so-called X protein. You know, if you want more details, you can ask at the end. I can show you a diagram, but I'm not going to insist any on the mechanism. The more complex property is the following, is that when the cells basically are equipped with a so-called refractory period, and this is easy to understand, when a cell is stimulated for reversal, there will be a lag of time. It cannot be stimulated again for a reversal. When the cells are in an off state, this refractory period is maximal, okay? But when the cells are converted into on the on state, this refractory period, the length of this refractory period, is dependent on the phosphorylation state of the kinase, and more specifically on the phosphorylation state of the second regulator. So that the more phosphorylated, the shorter the refractory period, and at some point you reach a minimal refractory period, which dictates basically the minimal oscillatory period, okay? Those behaviors, to really show you how that can be captured at the single cell level, I can show you two examples. You can see, for example, a cell here, green on the on state, and this one is at the maximum kinase level, so it has the minimal refractory period, and you see that it keeps oscillating back and forth. But the cell here undergoes transitions, okay? And so you see this one oscillates back and forth, but this one goes from an off state into an on state, and then you see it has a very regular oscillatory period. It can escape it, move in the off state, and then enter a new on state, and you see that here, basically, the wavelength is distinct, and this is due to the fact that the kinase is phosphorylated to an alternated level, okay? So, at the end of this, basically, I'm adding two new rules. Cells can rapidly switch between an on and off state, and cells are synchronized via the regulation of the refractory period. And so now I think we have all the ingredients that we can try to model those multicellular patterns and see, can we model the rippling state? And then, can we model the transition from the swarming to the rippling state? And this is work that was beautifully done by a graduate student in my group, Jean-Baptiste Sonnier, in collaboration with Vincent Calvet from the ENS Lyon. So what they did is basically write a very simple model. I'm not going to get into the equations, but basically the cells are modeled into basically two states. At low density, the reversals are off. And you see that really the distinction here is that this R star, it says that the refractory period here is constant in this state. Okay? When the cells are actually switching to a high cell density state, now what changes in the equation is that basically the refractory periods becomes variable, okay? And so now we can basically inject those properties and see, first, can we capture the rippling waves, okay? And so this is basically a 2D model where the cells are basically color-coded for more clarity. You know, again, we have this hypothesis that the cells are very highly aligned in these areas, so we start with an aligned state, and now we start, sending the model, and you see that after some time, you see equilibration, and you see really something that looks like the movement of those waves. But again, you know, what looks like the movement of those waves, we can actually refer it back to the experiment and see, does that really look like the movement of those waves? If you draw a chymograph, now, of these simulations, you see that you get those accordion wave movements, you get those cross-like patterns that you see, and you get single-cell trajectories that very nicely look similar to what you see in the experiment. What you can extract from this is, you know, again, this distribution of the time between reversals, and you see that you also get a bimodal distribution. One, basically, this peak corresponds to the cell basically moving in the high density areas, and you see those rapid reversals. This is peak one. And then you see that the cells can really escape from these areas and move into the off state, and this is actually the second peak. And just to this is basically the experimental data that's obtained from an experiment that's derived about this scale. And you see that although quantitatively we're missing some ingredient to actually really match the simulation, I think qualitatively we are capturing those two transitions. Okay, so we think that the model is quite satisfactory in capturing the rippling state. And this is basically if you basically try to this, you take this experiment and let's try to simulate this experiment, and we can get something like this. And you see that on the left side, okay, you see the formation of those rippling waves, and those rippling waves are nicely looking like the one that you capture in the experiments. So if I notice here that on the swarming side, we are not capturing the swarming side, and I'll get back to that, okay? But if you, on the rippling side, you measure basically, again, this is the experimental data of the bimodal distribution of the time between reversals, you see those two peaks occur also in the simulation, although the exact differences in the magnitudes of those peaks is not fully captured by the simulation. But okay, we are happy about this side, but we are not capturing this side. So what's going on, okay? And so if we go back to this initial movie I've been showing, you see that the Mixococcus cells, you know, tend to follow traces that are left by other cells. And so what you see in blue, which I actually did not introduce, are basically trajectories of the cells. This is not staining, this is computational trajectories. And you see that there is a tendency of cells to follow paths that are being laid out by other cells. Okay? So in other words, in these areas, the cell tend to deposit an extracellular matrix that's favored by the other cells, okay? So if we go back to the model, and now we say that we keep everything the same from rule 2 to rule 5, but we change rule 1, the cells are no longer highly aligned due to a predependent matrix, now the cells tend to follow a self-deposited matrix, you know? Is this sufficient to actually get, you know, swarming behaviors? So these are basically the experimental swarming behaviors. And this is the type of swarming behavior you can get into the simulation. And you see that it looks close enough. It looks close enough. Now you get those self-organization, you get those trails, and you get those cells moving along those trails. And if you look at the distribution, now this is the experimental distribution, and you see that this is the simulation. And here, the simulation, we think, looks, you know, promisingly similar to the experiment. We're losing the second peak, and now we're looking at something that could be looking like an experimental decay. If you now basically go back to this initial experiment, the idea, can we now simulate this entire experiment and have on one side the rippling and the other side the swarming state? And can this be captured by the model? You see that you can start this way. This here, for example, this area is divided here into the prey matrix. The rule is that the cells will become highly aligned. Here, this is a self-deposited EPS. The cells will follow their own trail. And you see that, you know, you get those behaviors, and you see that we're very satisfied to see that we're capturing something that looks quite similar to the experiment, and you can quantify the distribution. You see that in the rippling field, you indeed get the bimodal distribution, and you get the exponential decay distribution in the swarming area. So really, I think I'm going to close here. with three take-home messages. The first message is that transitions between swarming and rippling here only require, you know, changes in the extracellular matrix, and they do not necessitate any sort of genetic reprogramming. Here, the cell collisions are the key organizing principles, and the interesting property here is that the regulation of the so-called refractory period synchronizes neighboring cells, which allow rapid changes in the cell collective, because those synchronized cells then propagate, and that actually leads to the formation of these rippling waves. And in this way, I'll argue that local perturbations are propagated to the larger community by short-range interactions, very similar to those phenomena that you see in animal behaviors. And with this, I'll just thank you for your attention and be happy to take any question.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.